In the meantime, Aladdin's mother got home and showed in her countenance the good news she brought her son. "My son," said she to him, "you have now all the reason in the world to be pleased. The Sultan, with the approbation of the whole court, has declared that you are worthy to possess the Princess Badroulboudour, and waits to embrace you and conclude your marriage. Therefore, you must think of making preparations for your interview, which may answer the high opinion he has formed of your person." Aladdin, enraptured with this news, made little reply, but retired to his chamber. There, after he had rubbed the lamp, which had never failed him, the obedient genie appeared. "Genie," said Aladdin, "I want to bathe immediately, and you must afterward provide me the richest and most magnificent habit ever worn by a monarch." No sooner were the words out of his mouth than the genie rendered him invisible, and transported him into a bath of the finest marble, where he was undressed, without seeing by whom, in a magnificent and spacious hall. From the hall he was led to the bath, which was of a moderate heat, and he was there rubbed with various scented waters. After he had passed through several degrees of heat, he came out quite a different man from what he was before. His skin was clear white and red, his body lightsome and free, and when he returned into the hall he found, instead of his own, a suit the magnificence of which astonished him. The genie helped him to dress, and when he had done, transported him back to his own chamber, where he asked him if he had any other commands. "Yes," answered Aladdin. "I expect you to bring me as soon as possible a charger that surpasses in beauty and goodness the best in the Sultan's stables, with a saddle, bridle, and other caparisons worth a million of money. I want also 20 slaves, as richly dressed at least as any of the Princess Badroulboudour's, each carrying a complete dress fit for any sultaness. I want also 10,000 pieces of gold in 10 purses. Go, and make haste." As soon as Aladdin had given these orders, the genie disappeared, but presently returned with the horse, the 40 slaves, 10 of whom carried each a purse containing 10,000 pieces of gold, and 6 women slaves, each carrying on her head a different dress for Aladdin's mother, wrapped up in a piece of silver tissue. Of the 10 purses, Aladdin took 4, which he gave to his mother, telling her those were to supply her with necessaries. The other 6 he left in the hands of the slaves who brought them, with an order to throw them by handfuls among the people as they went to the Sultan's palace. The 6 slaves who carried the purses he ordered likewise to march before him, 3 on the right hand and 3 on the left. Afterward he presented the 6 women slaves to his mother, telling her that they were her slaves, and that the dresses they had brought were for her use. When Aladdin had thus settled matters, he told the genie he would call for him when he wanted him, and thereupon the genie disappeared. Aladdin's thoughts now were only upon answering, as soon as possible, the desire the Sultan had shown to see him. He dispatched one of the 40 slaves to the palace, with an order to address himself to the chief of the porters, to know when he might have the honour to come and throw himself at the Sultan's feet. The slave soon acquitted himself of his commission, and brought for answer that the Sultan waited for him with impatience. Aladdin immediately mounted his charger, and though he never was on horseback before, appeared with such extraordinary grace that the most experienced horseman would not have taken him for a novice. The streets through which he was to pass were almost instantly filled with an innumerable concourse of people, who made the air echo with their acclamations, especially every time the 6 slaves who carried the purses threw handfuls of gold among the populace. Neither did these shouts of joy come from those alone who scrambled for the money, but from a superior rank of people who could not forbear applauding Aladdin's generosity. Not only those who knew him when he played in the streets like a vagabond did not recollect him, but those who saw him but a little while before hardly recognized him, so much were his features altered. Such were the effects of the lamp, as to procure by degrees to those who possessed it perfections suitable to the rank to which the right use of it advanced them. Much more attention was paid to Aladdin's person than to the pomp and magnificence of his attendants, as a similar show had been seen the day before, when the slaves walked in procession with the present to the Sultan. Nevertheless, the horse was much admired by good judges, who knew how to discern his beauties, without being dazzled by the jewels and richness of his furniture. When the report was everywhere spread that the Sultan was going to give the princess in marriage to Aladdin, nobody regarded his birth nor envied his good fortune, so worthy he seemed of it in the public opinion. When he arrived at the palace, everything was prepared for his reception, and when he came to the gate of the second court, he would have alighted from his horse, agreeably to the custom observed by the Grand Vizier, the Commander-in-Chief of the Empire, and governors of provinces of the first rank. But the chief of the mace-bearers, who waited on him by the Sultan's order, prevented him, and attended him to the Grand Hall of Audience, where he helped him to dismount. The officers formed themselves into two ranks at the entrance of the hall. The chief put Aladdin on his right hand, and through the midst of them led him to the Sultan's throne. As soon as the Sultan perceived Aladdin, he was no less surprised to see him more richly and magnificently habited than ever he had been himself, then struck at his good mien, fine shape, and a certain air of unexpected dignity, very different from the meanness of his mother's late appearance. But notwithstanding, his amazement and surprise did not hinder him from rising off his throne and descending two or three steps quickly enough to prevent Aladdin's throwing himself at his feet. He embraced him with all possible demonstrations of joy at his arrival. After this civility, Aladdin would have thrown himself at his feet again, but he held him fast by the hand and obliged him to sit close to the throne. Aladdin then addressed the Sultan, saying, "I receive the honour which your Majesty, out of your great condescension, is pleased to confer, but permit me to assure you that I know the greatness of your power, and that I am not insensible how much my birth is below the lustre of the high rank to which I am raised. I ask your Majesty's pardon for my rashness, but I cannot dissemble that I should die with grief were I to lose my hopes of seeing myself united to the divine princess who is the object of my wishes." "My son," answered the Sultan, embracing him a second time, "you would wrong me to doubt for a moment of my sincerity. Your life from this moment is too dear to me not to preserve it by presenting you with the remedy which is at my disposal." After these words, the Sultan gave a signal, and immediately the air echoed with the sound of trumpets, hautboys, and other musical instruments. And at the same time he led Aladdin into a magnificent hall, where was laid out a most splendid collation. The Sultan and Aladdin ate by themselves, while the Grand Vizier and the great lords of the court, according to their dignity and rank, sat at different tables. The conversation turned on different subjects, but all the while the Sultan took so much pleasure in looking at his intended son-in-law that he hardly ever took his eyes off him. And throughout the whole of their conversation, Aladdin showed so much good sense as confirmed the Sultan in the high opinion he had formed of him. After the feast, the Sultan sent for the chief judge of his capital and ordered him to draw up immediately a contract of marriage between the Princess Badroulboudour, his daughter, and Aladdin. When the judge had drawn up the contract in all the requisite forms, the Sultan asked Aladdin if he would stay in the palace and solemnize the ceremonies of marriage that day, to which he answered, "Sir, though great is my impatience to enjoy your Majesty's goodness, yet I beg of you to give me leave to defer it till I have built a palace fit to receive the princess. Therefore, I petition you to grant me a convenient spot of ground near your abode, that I may the more frequently pay my respects, and I will take care to have it finished with all diligence."
"Son," said the Sultan, "take what ground you think proper. There is space enough on every quarter around my palace. But consider, I cannot see you too soon united with my daughter, which alone is wanting to complete my happiness." After these words, he embraced Aladdin again, who took his leave with as much politeness as if he had been bred up and had always lived at court.